We continue our rock theme here, talking with the rock and roll detective Jim Birkenstadt about his book, Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed. Among the mysteries he explores, did the Beach Boys' Dennis Wilson really get involved with Charlie Manson and with the Manson family? The answer, sadly, is yes, and the extent of his involvement with them goes way beyond anything that I thought I knew. Another question, Louie Louie, are the lyrics as filthy and pornographic as the FBI used to suspect? We're going to jump into that as soon as we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Jim Birkenstadt, I can recall as a youngster, every band that in a junior high and high school dance would play Louie Louie or some version of it. And people would whisper, boy, do you know how dirty those lyrics are? And I would listen to them. I couldn't understand most of them, but I figured, well, whatever the dirty lyrics are, they must be over my head because I couldn't find them. You went looking for them as well. And so did the FBI, it turns out.
Yes, it's true. The FBI spent roughly 2 years trying to find obscenity in the recording by the Kingsmen called Louie Louie. And not only that, in today's money, they spent roughly $63 million taxpayer dollars trying to find this obscenity. And they were really, when the investigation started, I found by looking at all of their records from this two-year investigation, of which there were about, 120, 150 pages, that they were really predisposed to trying to find obscenity in this recording, which, as you stated, very difficult to even understand the lyrics, let alone make out any words that are either obscene or not obscene.
I think I first heard a Paul Revere and the Raiders version of the song, and then later, in my part of the neck of the woods, I heard the Kingsmen version. I couldn't understand any of the lyrics, let alone find any good juicy porn in there.
Right. And, you know, when I looked into it and I talked with Jerry Denon, who's listed as a producer on the single, although he didn't actually physically produce the song, he was more of a distributor. But he put me in touch with other people who were there. And basically, at this session, it was kind of not a real studio, more like a garage type of situation back then, with a rope holding a microphone way up in the air. And if you've ever had to tilt your head all the way back and sing, or you could try this at home, it's very difficult, and your voice becomes strained. You're not able to breathe as well. And, you know, that was the situation under which Jack Eli of the Kingsmen recorded that song. Plus, the night before, they had been up late playing live, so I'm sure he was a bit hoarse as well. So I can understand how it might be hard to understand the lyrics.
Before we move on to the Beach Boys and Charlie Manson, my own personal Elvis expert is a guy named Jeff Taylor, who does a pretty mean Elvis impersonation here. He had sent in a question about Elvis's manager. You documented in the book that Elvis's first manager was Scotty Moore, long before Colonel Parker. And
that's correct. In fact, Scotty Moore was Elvis's first manager for the first year. He told me that through extensive interviews, and also the wording of their contract is illustrated in the book. And then the second year, a gentleman named Bob Neal took over as manager. So, those were two managers that came early on in Elvis's career.
The story I had heard was that Elvis's mom, who was so important in his life, did not like, in fact, maybe hated Colonel Parker when he came along. It was so controlling.
Well, I wasn't able to speak with her, unfortunately, but I can tell you that Scotty Moore, there was no love lost between him and Colonel Parker. He very vehemently disliked Colonel Parker, and, you know, probably I would say the main thing he didn't like was that Colonel Parker wanted 100% control over Elvis Presley's career and life. And that meant separating Elvis from any people close to him who might be able to influence him or say, well, that's not such a great idea that Colonel Parker's recommending. So, you know, he eventually isolated both Scotty Moore and Bill Black right out of the band.
On to the Beach Boys and Charlie Manson. And, of course, you know, that's a story you hear. You see it, a little mention of it in a documentary here or there, that there was a connection between Manson and Dennis Wilson. But you really dug into it and collected a lot of information I had never heard before, the extent of which it's really a sad, sad story. Sad.
It is a sad story. I mean, Dennis Wilson was the drummer for the Beach Boys. And what's interesting was, you know, the Beach Boys were epitomized as this clean-cut Southern California surfing group. But Dennis Wilson was the only Beach Boy who could actually surf. But they became extremely popular. They became extremely rich, successful, all at a very young age. And I think Dennis, maybe more than the other members, perhaps had trouble coming to grips with sudden fame at such an early age, a story that we've heard many times over for many people in the entertainment world. And, you know, you start to wonder, well, okay, I have all the money in the world, I have all the success, you know, but what's it really all about? And so Dennis Wilson started to explore that. And the first thing that happened was he came across the Maharishi, the same one that the Beatles also looked to, because they were having similar philosophical questions. And so he was really searching for more meaning in life at the time that Charles Manson had gotten out of prison, started to form his infamous family, which was made up of mostly a harem of women and a couple of guys. And they both had different needs. Charles Manson felt that he wanted to become a signed rock and roll star, someone signed to a label, so that he could get his messages, which I would call cult recruitment messages, out to a larger audience, and of course he would have a steady income. On the other hand, Dennis Wilson was in this band, and Brian Wilson, his brother, who had recorded all these and written all these wonderful hits, Brian was starting to experience health issues, mental health issues, and was using drugs, and that had slowed his creativity way down. And so the other Beach Boys at this time in 1968 and 69 needed to step up and provide some music. And so when Manson came into Dennis Wilson's circle, they both found that they might be able to help each other with their mutual needs.
And so Charlie Manson fancies himself a songwriter. He starts hanging out with Dennis Wilson, who spends a lot of money recording this and that, spends a lot of time with Manson and the family. And they come up on this song, this one particular song, that Wilson basically takes and changes, and the Beach Boys recorded it.
Yeah, it's amazing. The song was called Cease to Exist. And again, it was another cult recruitment song. Some of the words are pretty girl, pretty, pretty girl. Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. He was constantly trying to get women to give up their ego, their world, their family, and you know, be under his complete control. The Beach Boys, when Dennis Wilson obtained the song from Charles Manson, he brought it into the Beach Boys session for the reason I mentioned earlier. They were all trying to pitch in for the next album. And he changed the title to Never Learn Not to Love. And his version was, he rearranged it. It became more of a Beach Boys sounding song with their patented harmonies. And he changed the lyrics a little bit so that it was more of a love song and not a recruitment song for a cult leader. And so it's just a fascinating story that I used a lot of my legal background to delve into, did, you know, was there a deal between them? Was it a legal deal? Did it need to be in writing? If not in writing, is it enforceable as to who really owns this song? And then, of course, a lot of sensationalistic stories out there, like, did this alleged theft of a song lead Manson to the murders? So all these things were fascinating to me, and I had to really dive in and, you know, find witnesses to the, there was only one person left alive that actually witnessed the transaction. So to me, it was just fascinating.
So the Beach Boys record this song. You look into the gray areas of whether or not they had the legal right to do it. Could Charlie Manson have made a case if he wanted to, if he didn't have other problems on his plate? And, you know, I think back to that era. Artists, what they called, nicked things all the time. The Beatles did it. They would nick this right. or that, this bass line or this theme or set of lyrics. And sometimes people complained and sometimes they didn't, but it happened a lot. Led Zeppelin did it a lot, right?
That's absolutely right. A lot of people, and in fact, George Harrison was sued for My Sweet Lord by the publishing owners of the song He's So Fine, because, and ultimately the judge found that George Harrison had, I mean, I'm laughing because this is a ridiculous finding, but that George Harrison had subconsciously plagiarized the song for his song.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's, you know, a lot of people take little bits here and there, and it's a question of, will there be a lawsuit? Will someone make a claim, or will people let it go? Or is it okay? Is it okay under the law? And, this was just such a fascinating case because Manson was very interesting. He went from Dennis Wilson, you know, trying to get his help. Then he tried to get Doris Day's son.
Terry Melcher,
right. And tried to get him. He came out to the ranch and listened. And he felt so bad, you know. He knew this was not good enough to record. And here he was producing Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Birds, you know, big hits. And he's like, oh, my God, there's all these girls dancing around and Charlie Manson strumming on an old guitar. But he felt so bad, you know, but he did what a lot of producers do when they're trying to let someone down easy. He said, you know, I'm not exactly sure how to handle this type of music. You know, rather than saying it was awful. And then at the same time, he saw how these people were all very hungry and poor. So he gave Charlie $50. And he wanted him to use it, you know, for food. Well, Manson goes back to his girls when Terry Melcher leaves the ranch and says, we've got a record deal. He gave me an advance. Well, as we all know, advances are usually in writing as a written contract between a record label and the artist. And an advance is usually, even back then, an advance might have been anywhere from $10,000 to $60,000, but not $50. So, you know, Manson again was trying to impress his followers, but in the end, when he couldn't get that deal, that was one thing that made him upset. That these famous people were not really seeing the value of his great ability in his mind.
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? The question that bounced around in Dennis Wilson's head after, you know, things don't work out for Charlie in his recording contract. He goes on a murder spree with his followers. Dennis right. Wilson wondering, did I instigate this? I introduced him to all these music people. Did I instigate this? He was mad because the deal didn't work out.
Right. It is an interesting question. I think that Dennis Wilson felt a lot of guilt for befriending him. And what people should understand is that he befriended Charlie at a time when Charlie hadn't completely lost his mind by taking too much LSD, I think. And so he was at the time just thought of, Neil Young thought Charlie Manson was interesting and had a little bit of talent. And he was just this sort of crazy little chuckling hippie guy. And if you go, again, if you were living back in the 60s, there were a lot of these sort of people around that, you know, had a smooth way of talking and laughing, and everybody was getting high, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's just Charlie. But Charlie went into a very dark time. He was a racist and thought that the black people were going to rise up and have this big revolution in America, and that he would be the one to lead them after they, you know, killed all the white people. It was all a crazy, you know, LSD idea, but he blamed everybody but himself for all the things that happened, which is, you know, a shame.
You could say that Dennis Wilson was sort of on a bad path, on a downward slide prior to the Manson murders, but afterward, he does seem to go into a tailspin. You documented.
Yes. He felt terribly guilty. I know that Terry Melcher also, he went off to live near his mom, Doris Day, and didn't want to see people. He felt guilty. I just think they all felt bad that they had brought him into their world, and then he had, you know, terrorized L.A. and killed these innocent people who were both in the entertainment world and in the business world, and it was just an awful experience for them. And I think anyone would feel guilty and bad and, you know, might turn to drink or whatever to try to feel better about something.
Do you recall how long it is after the whole Manson episode before Dennis Wilson died, was killed, I guess, while diving?
Yeah, I think it was several years later. I mean, it might have been, I don't know the exact date, but it was at least 10 plus years, I think, after that. But it was a sort of a long decline. He was sort of ousted from the Beach Boys. He was, using alcohol and drugs to, you know, probably ease his emotional pain. At one point, I think he was homeless. So, yeah, he went through a really sad, terrible spiral. And it's a shame because, you know, he was a good person. He was talented. People liked him. And he just, you know, met the devil at the crossroads, and things did not go well.
That's sad. I'm just told he died in 83. You were involved with the production of Nirvana, the famous album Nevermind, which has this picture of a baby naked swimming in a pool. We're going to go to a break here in about 40 seconds, so we'll have to do it on the other side. But it's hilarious that the baby, now grown up, had been filed a lawsuit. I mean, more than one, maybe, in just the last year or so. We're going to hear that story.
Strange.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll hear that story on the other side and then get into Bob Marley versus the CIA. If we have time, maybe the best chapter in the book is about the Traveling Wilburys, which I think you had hands-on experience with those guys. And we'll open up the phone lines and see what's on the minds of our listeners as well. More to come here on Coast to Coast. We're talking with the rock and roll detective, Jim Birkenstadt, about his book, Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed. A lot of ground still to cover if we have time, and we'll go to your questions as well right after this in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Jim, I don't think we have time to go into a lot of detail about Bob Marley and the CIA, and I don't want to give it all away anyway. I hope people will check out your book, Mysteries in the Music, but can you sort of set the stage of why anyone would even consider the possibility that the CIA would be behind a plot to assassinate Marley?
Yes, absolutely, George. I think it was a time period where we were still in the Cold War with Russia, which is amazing because now we're back where we started.
Yep.
But in the 1970s, there was this Cold War between us and Russia. We were very concerned about the growth of either communism or socialism, specifically in the Caribbean area. Of course, Cuba had already gone that way, and we had already gone through the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Russia had put missiles, you know, pointed at the U.S. on Cuba, which was just literally a hop, skip, and a jump from Florida. So we started to see Jamaica moving in that direction, our company, our country. They had elected Prime Minister Manley, who was moving the country in a socialist direction. At the same time, U.S. multinational corporations were mining a mineral called bauxite, which we used for manufacturing aluminum. And when Manley refused to bow to Secretary of State Kissinger about his socialist leanings and nationalized the bauxite mining so that it really took away a lot of the profit of the U.S. corporations, Kissinger then sent in CIA agents posing as, quote, diplomats, in order to overturn Prime Minister Manley's leadership and overturn him at the ballot box. And so during that time, Bob Marley saw this back and forth that had become quite violent in Jamaica because the CIA had apparently brought lots of weapons in to the political party on the conservative side, again with the idea of overthrowing the socialist leadership. And so Bob just wanted to bring both sides together. He wasn't a political animal whatsoever. So he decided to put on a concert called Smile Jamaica. Unfortunately, Prime Minister Manley sort of co-opted it. And if you look in the book, you'll see a poster where it says, you know, the government of Jamaica sponsors this concert. And that really wasn't the truth, but they had to go to Manley for permission to put on the concert. So 2 days before the concert was to take place, gunmen smashed into Bob Marley's home and shot up the place. And there were, the Wailers were there and Bob was there rehearsing. And they got all, you know, shot everybody if they could and missed, basically, didn't kill anyone. But Bob Marley got hit in the elbow, and then he went to the hospital. He didn't die. No one died, luckily, fortunately. So you had people who started to create these theories about the CIA was there, so they must have wanted Marley dead in order to prevent him from helping Prime Minister Manley win re-election as a socialist. And then actually I found there was a second conspiracy theory about him being killed by a soccer shoe with a copper wire that contained cancer on it. And so I go deep dive into this, and I'm able to find classified CIA documents, talk to witnesses. I even talked to one of the CIA agents in charge who was posing as a diplomat at the time.
Yeah, that's a good chapter. Really a lot of detail that I had never heard of before, including the appearance somebody imported a whole bunch of machine guns and spread them around on the island, and there were all kinds of shootings, huh?
Yeah, it was crazy. And the other thing that fueled this fire is of conspiracy is that at the time, Island Records had hired a film crew to film the concert, and the cameraman was named Carl Colby, and coincidentally, he was the son of former CIA director William Colby.
Oh, man.
So that added to all of it.
I think we're going to have to take some calls here now, and maybe we'll get to the Wilburys with some of these questions that are popping up, but let's go to the phones. We're going to the wild card line, Barry in South Carolina. Hey, Barry, how you doing?
Hello there, George, and I'm telling you, buddy, what a show tonight. Keep it up, buddy. Lord Huron is the greatest new band out there, and I appreciate you playing it. You turned me on to them. But listen, for your guest, the very first record, 45 RPM I ever bought was about 1958 or 59. I was a teenager in high school, and it was on Sun Records, and it was Jerry Lee Lewis doing "You Shake My Nerves and You Rattle My Brain." Too much of love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
Barry, you missed your calling, man. You should have got a contract there. You know, it is interesting, Jim, that there's Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash, B.B. King, Carl Perkins. All those guys were at Sun Records.
Yeah. It's amazing, all the people that he discovered.
It's just all under one roof, and Roy Orbison, too, right?
Yeah, Roy Orbison as well. And interestingly, of course, Roy became a member of the Traveling Wilburys.
Right.
Later in life.
Right. We have Joe in the Bronx who had a question about musicians who use anonymous names or nom de plumes. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
How you doing, George?
All right.
Good. Yeah, Jim, I heard that Paul McCartney had used an alias to attach to recordings that he had made for basically not for distribution, but for his friends. And I think the alias, the last name was Trillington. Can you shed some light on that?
Yes, the Thrillington was a name that he used to create an orchestral version of his rock album, Ram. And so each song is sort of an orchestrated version of the songs on his Ram solo LP. And he used Percy Thrills Thrillington.
That's right.
As the name, and it's interesting because for many years people didn't know that that was Paul, and I think maybe probably 10 years later he admitted, yeah, I put out this album, and he was probably a little shy about doing an orchestrated album in 1971, it was just something he liked to try, and he's always been a great creative experimenter, but he did use that pseudonym on the Thrillington album.
And Joe, he also used, the Fireman. He recorded a couple of albums under the Fireman. I've used those on this program, some of those songs. It's great music. And of course, as you noted in your book, Mysteries in the Music, as a Beatle, when he traveled around and checked into hotels, he used the name Paul Ramone, which if I'm not positive, but I think the Ramones may have taken their name from that.
I'm not positive either, but that could be in the next book.
Yeah. run that rumor to ground. And, you know, it sort of leads into the Traveling Wilburys is that the Beatles had used, they had alter egos for Sergeant Pepper's and where they assumed these other names. And that sort of is I don't know if it's an inspiration for the Traveling Wilburys, but it was a precursor to them, what they did.
Right. Well, you know, I think that Paul felt we're moving in a new direction. This is 1967, and it might free us creatively to change our name to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and leave the little Fab Four boys behind because we're grown men now and we're experimenting and more creative. And he has spoken on that, how that was creatively freeing for them. In the case of the Traveling Wilburys, I think George Harrison remembered that and also wanted the experience for the superstars in the band to also be anonymous while they recorded and just to have some fun as well. I mean, they came up with some very silly names and a very silly backstory.
Well, that chapter of your book is maybe my favorite. It was so much fun reading it and hearing all these details. I knew some of it, but not all of this. Mm-hmm. And it really comes across about how much fun those guys had working together. It was like very loose and a lot of laughs. It wasn't as much tension as what George Harrison had in the Beatles. I remember reading seeing the film, Martin Scorsese's movie about George Harrison living in the material world. And I guess you were a consultant to that, which they have Tom Petty telling the story about how they came up with Handle With Care and the name of the band. That was great stuff.
It was a great film to work on. I was the historical consultant for the movie, and it was 3 years of absolute pleasure digging up things for that film and helping them find what they were looking for. Great film about George's life if you're interested in George Harrison.
Yeah, if people have not seen that, check that out. It's just a terrific film all the way around. So we'll go back to the phones. Let's see Bill in Los Angeles on the Wild Card line. Hi, Bill.
Hi, George. Yeah, I just happened to be watching that Scorsese documentary again on VCR last week. So, it's great. Great work on that, Jim. Hey, George, along with Louis Salinas, I'm sure you recall the moral outrage over McCartney's High, High, High.
Oh, yeah.
And Chuck Berry's My Ding-a-Ling. It was just hysterical. seeing him do that on TV, just to poke it in the government's eye.
I think that McCartney's song got banned by the BBC because they thought it was about drugs, when in fact it was pretty raunchy sexual stuff, the whole song.
Right. But yeah. Jim, can you shed any light on the allegation that the Pentagon had some connection with a disappeared member of Iron Butterfly?
You know, that's one mystery that I haven't delved into, really, haven't looked into, although it did come up while I was researching. And there's the possibility, the stories from this book and others, including that one you mentioned, are currently being shopped around with myself and a partner, a writing partner who worked with VH1 Behind the Music. And that's one of the mysteries that we'll want to delve into if we can turn this book into a TV docuseries.
Bill, thanks for the question. We move on. West of the Rockies, Michael, in Albany, New York. I'm pretty sure that's not west of the Rockies, but we'll take the call anyway. Hi, Michael.
Hi. How are you, George?
Okay. What's on your mind?
A couple of things as he talks. I'm just thinking maybe the Maharishi infected a lot more than just his problem with the lady and the little girl, you know? Then there's the other question about the Beatles.
Yeah.
I was wondering why he didn't add Yoko Ono in one of the comments. She has two restaurant areas, one nearby Madison and the Rockefeller Plaza, and the other is a bar restaurant at the hotel over by Clinton and Pearl. So I find a lot of memories in what he's talking about.
I can imagine. You know, Yoko Ono, I didn't know she had restaurants, but you do document in your book, Jim, that Yoko's husband had a lot of anonymous names, nom de plumes, that he used himself.
He did. You know, again, back in the day, before lawyers had figured out how to hire, how artists could be hired out and work on other albums, they just hadn't contemplated that. Back then, you know, you were signed to one label, and that's where you had to record. Back then, you know, artists became friends with other artists and wanted to work with them on their albums, and so they would just make up these funny names in order to, you know, just be able to play on another album so they could say to their friends, yeah, that's me on there, but I couldn't use my real name. And then that was their way of just avoiding the whole legal thing. None of them wanted, you know, they were all very well off. They didn't need money for being at a session. It was just something that was fun for them. And I think they enjoyed all these different nom de plumes that they used.
So they would do it just so they could play music with their friends, and then it's an inside joke. Hey, that's me on that album.
Right, exactly.
First-time caller Jerry in Denver. Hi, Jerry. You're on with Jim Birkenstadt. Hello? I think Jerry's lost. We're going east of the Rockies to Joe in Long Island. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Jim. I just want to ask you about some of the cryptic names of album covers, like Who's Next, Eat a Peach, Brain Salad Surgery, Machine Head. Kind of cryptic to me.
You know, I haven't really looked into that area, but it is an interesting one. You're giving me a good idea there, because there is a story behind almost every album title, because most of the time, bands record the music, and then someone says, well, what are you going to call this album? And then you have to wonder, okay, well, what was that all about? What was that story? Why did we call it that? I think on Who's Next, it might have to do with the fact that on the cover, you can see that they are relieving themselves on a cement block, and maybe they're taking turns because they've all been drinking a lot of beer or something, and now it's, well, who's next? But I'm not positive of that. But I like the idea of looking into the stories behind album titles.
See, that's three books down the road. Thanks to all, thanks to all of our callers. It strikes me, Jim, that what you're doing now in writing these books and researching this stuff is way more fun than being a lawyer.
Oh, I can't tell you. You know, I like to tell people I'm a recovering attorney because, you know, as an attorney, you're always fighting with someone on the other side. But when you're helping, you know, bands and record labels and you're writing books and things, what you're doing is very creative and collaborative. And that's a lot more fun than fighting with people every day in court.
Well, Mysteries in the Music, Case Closed, is a lot of fun. I hope people check it out. Thank you very much for being here. I hope you'll return when the next book is done.
Thanks very much, George. It's been a real pleasure and an honor speaking with you, and I will definitely return with the next book.
All right. That's Jim Birkenstadt, the rock and roll detective. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Dr. Barry Taff, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Adam Thompson and Donna Walker, our webmaster, Ryan Stacey, Dan Galania, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, everyone. Take care. See you then.